This is a cautionary tale about how public policy, formulated for political reasons, can make scientific knowledge disappear for decades.
I'm Dr. Stephen Ross, NYU School of Medicine, Bellevue Hospital. I'm an addiction psychiatrist. In 2006, I was being supervised by a colleague, Jeffrey Gus, and there was a 50th anniversary of the discovery of LSD. And I said to him, why would anyone commemorate that? And he said to me, well, it was actually part of psychiatry for a long time. I never heard about any of that in my medical training or psychiatric training. So I started to look at the old literature, and what I found astounded me. You know, hidden in plain sight, psychedelics had been a big part of psychiatry for close to a quarter of a century, over 1,000 studies, tens of thousands of research participants, and the Controlled Substance Act, putting all of these substances into Schedule I, Nixon declaring war on drugs, was so effectively suppressed them that they were erased from the education of people in medicine and psychiatry and psychology. And I just couldn't believe that all this interesting research had happened and I never knew about it.
That was then. Today, Stephen Ross runs a lab at NYU, and it's one of a handful that has won approval from the FDA and the DEA to go back to investigating the therapeutic benefits of psychedelic drugs. He told Steve Paulson what they found.
Well, by far the most promising indication is the use of psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy to treat cancer-related anxiety and depression, including fear of death. Our group and the Johns Hopkins group recently published on December 1st the largest and best controlled trials of using a psychedelic agent with psychotherapy to treat cancer-related distress. And what we both found was very interesting, that a single dose of psilocybin versus placebo led to immediate and very large-scale reductions in anxiety and depression. 80% of our participants went into immediate remission from their depressive symptoms, and this endured over many months. And we found that psilocybin induced these unusual mystical-type experiences that have been described in the psychology of religion, have been validated by Johns Hopkins. And we found 70% of our participants said this was the singular top five most meaningful experience of their lives.
But, I mean, the fact that this profound change can happen from a single dose, that's kind of staggering, I have to say.
Well, I really had a hard time believing it at first because I came to this not, you know, knowing anything about this line of research or being interested. And we kept having patients. A typical patient was a woman in her mid-50s who had metastatic gynecologic cancer and who was dying. And they would say by the end of the day, I feel dramatically better. My depression is gone. My anxiety is gone. I'm not worried about the dying process. And then they would continue for weeks to months to say, I feel so much better. Some patients saying, you know, the symptoms never came back. And I really was skeptical. I thought, how can this be? This doesn't make any sense. But after doing it close to 30 times, and then we looked at the data, I realized that we really had, you know, it was a profound finding that it could work so rapidly and have such a sustained clinical benefit.
How do you explain that?
I think it goes back to the nature of the experience. These are patients that have cancer. They come in there, they're primed to have an experience that's related to cancer. The intention for the day is to deal with their cancer-related distress, much different than how these drugs are used recreationally.
So these people are going in with a certain intention, and that's important here. I mean, they want a particular kind of experience to result from taking psilocybin.
Yes, that's key. We spend a lot of time with the participants ahead of time. We get to know the history of their life in great detail. We get to know the history of cancer. You know, they come in and there's a small ritual with the two therapists. We hold hands with them. We ask them to state their intention for the day. We give them the pill. They lie down. We put eye shades. And it's a long day. It's 8 hours. Sometimes they sit there the entire time not moving. It looks like they're sleeping. But when they get up, they start to tell these very interesting tales of where they've been. And a little bit like a waking dream, but the themes center around cancer, death, distress, you know, seeing themselves die, having death experiences, getting new bodies, you know, that weren't cancer riddled, and all kinds of interesting things.
So this is not just euphoria. It sounds like some of this is pretty difficult. There might be an element of the bad trip here.
Yes, these are mixed experiences. Sometimes people can have euphoric, ecstatic experiences of bliss. I mean, love is reported a lot. Patients come back, they say, I experienced ultimate love. I experienced the power of love. I know now love is the most important force in the universe. But just about everyone had some other difficult things come up. Typically, they would pass through it and then reach a sense of sort of being at peace or serenity or powerful intuitive insights that they came through the difficult parts better off.
Now, we've been talking about the use of psilocybin for end-of-life anxiety. They seem to be effective for addiction as well. What are you finding there?
Well, that's really what got me so excited about this field. I'm an addiction psychiatrist, and I thought, wow, these are such interesting tools. And they made sense to me because an addiction can be understood as this kind of spiritual malady of sorts, and we have 12-step and Alcoholics Anonymous, and I even came to learn the story of Bill Wilson that I'd never heard before, that he got sober in 1934 from a drug-induced psychedelic experience with belladonna alkaloid.
Really? I didn't know that. Huh.
Yeah, he was a hopeless alcoholic here in Manhattan, and his doctor, William Silkworth, recommended this new treatment, this belladonna alkaloid, which blocks this acetylcholine receptor and can make people delirious, psychotic, and I guess have mystical experiences. And he had this white light of that he experiences God penetrating from outside to, you know, his hospital room. He had a mystical vision of alcoholics forming a chain to each other. That was his vision of the mutual self-help part of it. And in the 50s, he heard that LSD was being studied. He went to UCLA and underwent approximately 5 sessions of LSD psychotherapy. Thought that the mystical experiences were so important, he wanted to introduce actually LSD into AA, which of course never happened.
So what are you finding then about when people come into your lab, you know, suffering from alcoholism, how effective is this?
Well, Michael Bogenschutz, who we recruited from New Mexico, he did a pilot trial there, open label in 10 participants with alcoholism. And what he found is that psilocybin mixed with this type of psychotherapy, motivational interviewing, led to these dramatic reductions in drinking outcomes. So he and I used that data and designed a controlled trial, which we're doing now at NYU. We're about a third of the way done. We haven't broken the blind, so we don't know. But Johns Hopkins is also doing psilocybin research. Matt Johnson is leading a trial there of using psilocybin to treat tobacco addiction. And his pilot trial is also astounding. He treated 10 people. At 6 months follow-up, 80% were completely sober, which was biologically verified. So as an addiction physician, I'm really excited. I also want to try psychedelics to treat opiate addiction. We have a huge public health problem going on with opiates, and we're studying them for alcohol, but I'd love to design a trial to help opiate addicts.
Are basically all the same things at play here in the brain? I mean, is it, whether we're talking about addiction or depression or end-of-life anxiety, presumably the stuff, I mean, psilocybin is producing a particular effect on the brain.
There's a very appealing model put forth by Robin Carhart-Harris of the Imperial Group in London. And what he found was very interesting. He found through fMRI that psilocybin deactivated a part of the brain called the default mode network. The default mode network is a part of the brain that when we're reflecting on who we are, thinking about the future, or when our brain is just sort of resting, a lot of energy is being consumed. And some think that it's the kind of biological basis of the ego. And the default mode network is hyperactive in diseases like depression and addiction, which are these sort of like overly constrained ways of thinking and feeling.
You can sort of get locked into a negative loop. I mean, you keep thinking these bad thoughts and it just sort of repeats over and over again.
Exactly. Or the cancer patient, I'm stuck here, my life's over, I'll never get out of this. Or the addict, I'm giving up, I just have this relationship with the drug, I'm always going to be a slave to it. And what psychedelics do is they deactivate the default mode network. It's possible that they kind of get you out of this constrained, repetitive, obsessional loop and reconnect you to other ways of thinking and feeling, which can kind of break the fever, if you will. But we don't think that it's curative. We think that it kind of opens a door to a different way of thinking, feeling, perceiving, but that you really then need to work with the patient in psychotherapy to facilitate that process. That's our model at NYU.
Mm-hmm. It seems like there's a huge question here, which is, I mean, obviously something powerful is happening in the brain, but is it sort of just this one-time experience that causes this huge psychological and emotional experience, this overwhelming experience that then people take back? Or is something actually changing in the brain after that single dose of psilocybin? I mean, is the brain getting rewired?
Well, I think it's all the same. When you have a big experience that's highly instructive, it creates profound memory pathways. So whatever is happening, there's definitely something happening in the brain. The psychological experience is there's a neural underpinning to it. And what those changes are and how they're different and how they actually make people better is we got to dig deeper. There's something really interesting there, but we don't fully understand it yet.
I have to say, it all sounds a little like magic. I mean, you take one pill in the proper setting, you know, with the right clinical people there to look out for you, and potentially a lifetime of anxiety disappears.
Well, I tend to shy away from hyperbole and magic and cure. I worry people would think that this is going to be some magic cure. And in particular, I worry that people in the lay public will go out and try to find mushrooms. That's when people get into trouble with psychedelics, because you don't know what you're getting. It's illegal. You don't have any licensed clinicians that can give this to you. And it's just a crapshoot. But it's heartbreaking. So many distressed people. Nothing has worked. Please help me. I need help now. And we say, we'll put you on a list. You know, we'll hope to get you involved in phase three. No, I'm dying now. My family member needs help now. What can I do? How can I go get it? And I say, I'm sorry. I cannot advise you to do that. So it's very difficult.
Yeah. So what's the future for psychedelics, particularly in terms of these possible therapeutic treatments?
Well, I think psychiatry is going to look a lot different in 5 to 10 years. And the three main models, and there's many more, but the three main models, and these are three trials that are going to be happening in my laboratory at NYU. One is the use of ketamine for depression. And ketamine is a big breakthrough in psychopharmacology, the first agent in 50 years that works rapidly. And ketamine is a psychedelic drug. Then you have psilocybin for cancer and depression. And then you have MDMA for PTSD. I think these are the three paradigms that are the future of psychiatry. They're so radically different, and they're, you know, going after very difficult to treat disorders that with psychopharmacology we haven't done a great job doing. I can't tell you how many students and psychiatric residents are so excited that this is the dawn of a new field. You know, and it's not like, you know, 10, 20 years away. The research is mature. It's been going on now, building for 2 decades around psilocybin and MDMA. So it's an interesting and exciting time.
Stephen Ross. He's an addiction psychiatrist at NYU's School of Medicine and Bellevue Hospital, and he was talking with Steve Paulson.